Welcome to episode 136 of the Omni Gamers Club podcast, the podcast where we discuss games on all platforms, including Zork. My name is Mark Uessa. How are you doing?
And my name is Daniel Winter. I am doing well, thanks. Yeah.
Great. I almost gave your name away. That would have been a spoiler. Thought you should deserve that right to announce yourself.
For those listening for the first time, yes.
Yeah, we are the regular cast, the two of us. So it sounds like we're doing this for the first time, but no, believe it or not, 136 times. Yeah, we're back to the regular show. We're going to cover a variety of games during our main segment. We have a short appetizer, which might be a little shorter than usual this time around. And then we have a dessert period at the end where we cover kind of non-gaming stuff that's interesting us. That's the general shtick.
Yeah, so I guess this week you don't have anything for the appetizer, right? I think we've both been a little disillusioned with the state of news media, or games news, at least, in light of all the other news in the world right now.
Yeah, I mean, there's very, very minor stuff, but nothing worth mentioning to a great degree. I watched the Nintendo Partner Showcase, which was, you know, mildly interesting, but nothing that I want to add. I don't want to add to the hype cycle without actually knowing a lot of concrete details.
Yeah, I didn't watch that. I did see there was another trailer for Orbitals, I think it's called, that sort of very retro anime style. Apparently, it's actually like a two-player co-op akin to It Takes Two or Split Fiction.
Yeah, I was surprised to see that. I mean, that game looks visually impressive, and I would love to play that with, you know, my kid. I don't know if they would understand kind of the reference to the old school 1980s and 90s anime that, you know, I so much enjoy. But, you know, I'm all for split-screen co-op games, that's for sure.
Especially when apparently they have that new thing with the Switch 2 where you can sort of stream it to an older Switch simultaneously. So I would probably be experimenting with that.
Yeah, that was news to me, and I think that's positive news. Anyone that's putting out a split-screen co-op game, especially a game you can share between multiple consoles on the same network, is great news to me.
Yeah, so that aside, I did read various interesting articles this last week, but I want to avoid getting onto my soapbox again. I'm going to put that away for the week and talk about something more sort of human interest story, I guess. That is, I watched a gaming documentary called Get Lamp. So this is a documentary from director Jason Scott. I came across this with a podcast I follow called the Game Studies Study Buddies. Recently did an episode on that and alerted me to it. It's from about 2010, I think. And you can watch it for free. There was a Google Tech Talk, I think it was, that streamed this, available and free on YouTube. I'll drop the link in the show notes. And, I mean, obviously, Mark, I think you used to have a podcast all about text adventures, so this is right up your alley, because if you get the reference, this is a documentary all about the art of text adventures.
That's right, Get Lamp. It's very the famous command from the series now. I guess there's multiple games in the series of Zork games. The very first one was a text adventure game. I think the first three were text adventure games, and then they've made graphical versions as well. Yeah, you're right. I did have a podcast where basically I played I basically GM'd, acting as the computer, where my guests would play through a text adventure game together. So I would describe to them the scenario. They would give me the prompts and describe back what was going on. And it was actually really, really fun. One of my, I think my very first podcast, actually. And I tried to make a little bit of a audio play out of it. So I would add special effects, soundtrack with music in the background, and try and read, you know, dramatically as much as possible. Unfortunately, the show went defunct, mostly just due to my efforts in enabling it. And I let the domain name go defunct. This was called the Let's Play Podcast, by the way. I ran that about 3 or 4 years ago. But I still have the original episode, so I should find another place to share that. To give you a long-winded answer to your short question, most of my familiarity is with later graphical adventure games, kind of the LucasArts variety. I played some of the classic text adventure games, like A Smattering of Zork and other text adventure games, but most of the experience I have with text adventure games, sometimes called interactive fiction.
Yes.
Or IF, is with the newer generation, you know, the kind of Twine engine-based games. Most of the games we played were short, like 15 minutes to kind of an hour and a half sort of affairs.
Yeah, it's really interesting. It almost seems akin to sort of the actual plays that you see in tabletop RPGs right now. I mean, obviously, the original, you know, the peak of interactive fiction as a commercial product was actually a pretty tiny window that has continued to have its niche following, but it's also evolved in some other interesting ways. So it's cool to see how people are playing with that format. But yeah, this did briefly delve into the history of the genre through largely through the lens of the company Infocom, looking through Colossal Cave Adventures and Zork through the mid-80s, basically. And it really was just like a 2 or 3 year peak before that whole industry started to crumble under the growing innovations of video games. But yeah, it wasn't so much on just the history, but it was just talking to a lot of the people in the community, both developers and fans alike, about the how they go about making this, the design of the puzzles and the fiction going into it. So their focus on how it has evolved in recent years is, like, I think it was called Interactive Fiction Competition, or IF Comp, I think it's called. Basically, they're all 2 hour short pieces of text adventures that have been created as part of a yearly competition. But I'm sure there are other versions of that out there now as well. As you mentioned, the Twine games, I don't know if you feel that visual novels are at all adjacent to this. I mean, I know you're going to be talking about one of those later, perhaps.
Yeah, visual novels, I think, are a little bit different because a lot of them don't have so much interactivity to them, or don't have too much branching to them. I mean, you could argue that a lot of text adventure games, interactive fiction games, don't either. They often will have a linear plot, one ending in you puzzles, like literal puzzles. And that would be the distinction between that and a visual novel, where there's no real friction in those visual novels. But it's a wide range. And even the modern day text adventure games written in Twine or things like that, it's not as if they don't all have visuals. Sometimes they do, or sometimes they will use graphical effects, such as changing the color of the text and displaying text in graphically appealing pattern, like maybe like raindrops on the side of a car window as you're driving or something like that. So they do achieve kind of interesting things with the format. And it's a really vibrant community, despite not being large. I think the web resource I made use of quite a bit was IFDB, which lists some of the freely available IF games. And there are notable authors who've written dozens of games. And some I would go back to multiple times because they're just kind of like award winners, probably winners of that IF comp you were mentioning.
Yeah, a couple of quick, a few takeaways from the documentary I thought worth pointing out is, like, there was one interview from, I think it was the developer of the MUD system, the multi-user dungeon, which is basically a almost like a chat room, but MMO, but text only, essentially. And he was talking about this, the magic of text, and how, like, when everything is text, input, all the input is text and all the output is text, it creates this sort of this real synchronicity of immersion, I guess, that you don't always necessarily guess when you're sort of crossing the streams of the various graphical displays.
That's right. Yeah, there is. It's pretty much like having the difference between a book and a movie of that book, right? You have an entire gaping maw of agreement or disagreement with how to interpret such a piece, and everyone had a different casting or something in mind for a certain character. Yeah, and I wanted to point out an interesting thing as well, is that there is actually a podcast that covers interactive fiction, new interactive fiction, that is much more successful than mine. Although it's not really covering some of these published games, it's more covers the cross-section between interactive fiction, tabletop role-playing games, and escape games. Because a lot of these interactive fictions will be literal escape games, or they'll kind of reach the end through a series of puzzle games. And that podcast is called Escape This Podcast. And then they turn around the episodes and they will call them Podcast This Escape. So they will do a recap of the escape with notable game developers or publishers guesting as either the player participants or even the authors of new escape audio escape rooms, because each episode they create an original new audio escape room. So I really think they're doing amazing work there over on Escape This Podcast.
It's an interesting analogy, because when you look at some of the physical retail products from the heyday of text adventures, a lot of them came with a lot of props and physical documents and sort of, you know, the wheels and puzzle items that you could interact with physically, which looks a lot like some of the escape room games you get now, the Exit series or the I can't remember the other one, but there's a few of these now that come with a bunch of props that you can interact with as part of a physical analog tabletop puzzle.
That's right. Boxed text adventure game products and a lot of the early graphical adventure game products came with these things called feelies, and that was the industry term for them, is like things you could pull out and feel. They might be like a cloth map, they might be like a, you know, cellophane, like a gel or something of red that you could hover over this pattern to show the hidden information underneath. Might be a compass or something like that. And oftentimes they would be security measures, because yes. Software was very easy to copy and distribute back then as it is now. So they would expect that the player would periodically have to check, oh, what is the second word of the 12th sentence, 12th line on page 32? And you would have to pull out the book or have to turn the dial.
The decryption key, yeah.
That's right. So, you know, smart, clever mechanisms of old to prevent software piracy, which is still going on today.
One other quick point I wanted to bring up is, obviously, as you can imagine, this documentary was very white, shall we say. A lot of old white dudes talking about interactive fiction. And a lot of that is obviously beholden to the types of people who had access to this back in the day and were working in that scene. There were a couple of notable exceptions. Marianne Buckles, who's widely credited as one of the first sort of video game academics, essentially. I was an interview with her. But also, I did appreciate, they actually spoke to several people with vision disabilities who were interacting with text adventures through text readers and other forms of technology. That was a fascinating vision through to how people are interacting with this, and how text is a very accessible form of media still in its various forms. And almost there was this analogy with how descriptive a lot of these scenes are. You look at a room and describing it all in intricate detail is often how you see, like, what do you call it, descriptive text for a movie subtitles, for example.
Right. And the interesting thing about a lot of these game engines is that they would have something called a parser. Parser is sometimes called an interpreter. So that software would have to be able to interpret or parse commands in a variety of different forms, and you wouldn't have to type in exactly the same thing. So, you know, get lamp would be an example of a command that you could give, but also pick up lamp or pick up thing, or instead of go north, you can type in north, or just N, the letter N, and that it would have to be able to interpret that as well. So I think that that's like a prime example of accommodation and affordance for different ways of thinking. Of course, you would need a different input device if you don't have the capability of typing on a typical keyboard. But, you know, you could speak into a device, a microphone that might interpret that into text as well. So I think it's a great tradition to be able to have a format that's, you know, widely accessible for all sorts of people, including the visually impaired.
Yeah, I mean, speaking of passes, though, that does bring to mind one other final point I wanted to make was, I mean, obviously that's going to create a lot of friction when you can't quite interpret what the parser wants and can't get the exact language right. You're not thinking in exactly the same way as the author. But watching some of the early press they showed about how, you know, the amazing way you can talk to the machines and they'll talk back to you, there's a lot of analogies to the way people are talking about AI right now, and that's it's all come full circle again.
I bet, yeah. I mean, that was ultimately the dream, is that the the computer would be alive, sort of like a GM when you couldn't have another human around to play like a tabletop role-playing game with you. The computer could sort of act as that moderator for the adventure that you're going on. They can track all that inventory. Inventory systems were critical to these games as well. And of course, they laid the foundation of graphical adventure games, such as, you know, Monkey Island or, Maniac Mansion. And then, you know, those would lay the foundation for vast genre of action adventure games like Resident Evil or the Deus Ex series we're talking about. You know, those games that are graphical puzzle adventure games with inventories and clever interactions, like that's all part and parcel of the same tradition. So I think that, you know, text parser adventure games are alive and well with us right now, whether people can recognize it or not.
Certainly, but I have to appreciate the authored experiences that go into his rather than just, you know, generated slop, shall we say.
One final tangent is that speaking of generated slop, is that adventure of that episode of The Next Generation, which I know you must have seen, where Data and LaForge go into the holodeck and play their adventure game where they're playing Sherlock Holmes.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And of course, the long and short of it is that Data has just memorized every Holmes novel. So, of course, he knows the answer and he instantly goes to it. LaForge complains, well, that's not a challenge, Data. Like, you're just memorizing these and spitting them out. So, of course, they ask the computer to generate a text adventure, an adventure game in the style of Arthur Conan Doyle. And then trouble ensues. So that just makes me think of generated AI slop all the time.
Sure, that reminds me, one final point, I promise this time. There was one interviewer, I can't recall who, talking about like this sort of puzzle design philosophy and how he liked games where if you knew the solution, you could finish the game with a single prompt at the start, and it's more a matter of discovering that. And it reminds me of what we see is what people would call Metroidbranias right now, where where knowledge is key, and you're extracting knowledge rather than having to go through the motion of solving something every time. So it's some interesting analogs to current game theory coming around again.
Very cool.
So yeah, great documentary. I recommend checking it out. And I had to the point. I forget what it was.
It'll come back to you. All right, shall we dive into our main course?
Yes, do you want to go ahead first, Mark, since I've been talking a bit there?
Sure, let's do that. Okay, so I thought I might be talking about Zelda a little bit, but I'm going to hold on to the title that I was playing for another week at least and play a bit more of that. Speaking of Metroidbranias, I'll be talking a little bit about that soon. But no, the title I'm talking about tonight, I played a little while ago. The game is called Steins Gate. Steins:Gate, I think. And this is a game that's on multiple platforms now. It was originally for the PC, PS3 generation, and PS Vita. I played it on the PS Vita, the original, by the way, PS Vita system, not emulated. But nowadays, it's on Xbox platforms, PS4, and even mobile devices. So Steins Gate, the original, came out in 2009. It's a science fiction visual novel game. We talked about visual novels. And it was developed by 5PB and Nitro Plus, whose games, they've come out with multiple sequels, even a prequel, and then other games as well. But I'm not super familiar with them. I was more familiar with Steins Gate kind of by the legend of it. I think they've like done things like created like audio dramas. I know that there's a music CD of Steins Gate, and there's
an anime, right?
There's an anime as well.
Yeah, okay.
As well. So this
game came first.
The game, I believe, came first. Yeah, and it has long tendrils, let's just say. So this is the second game in the science adventure series by this publisher, following a game called Chaos Head. I haven't played. But this one is, I mentioned it's science fiction, but it's set in aka the modern world. So in the early 21st century, in Japan, specifically in the neighborhood of Akihabara, which many people know is the kind of the nerd, otaku, anime, and technology hub of Tokyo, which is already a nerdy and technologically advanced city to be in.
And very popular video game setting.
Absolutely. And also animation setting. The protagonist's name is Okarin. That's just a nickname given to him by his childhood friend. He's a 19-year-old Chunibyo. Chunibyo is, it's hard to kind of translate, but it's basically the term for like this, they call it middle school syndrome or edgelord syndrome. This is kind of like a young person with delusions of grandeur. And they think they're the center of the fate of the world. They're a hero.
15-year-old child, right, basically.
Yeah, exactly like that. And they see conspiracies everywhere. And this character, Okarin, he thinks that there's some sort of agency after him for his secrets, although there's very little proof that's actually going on. So there's a little bit of like this undependable narrator aspect going on there. Anyways, the protagonist, he's not really the main draw of this. There's a wide cast of supporting characters. All of them are interesting in their various degrees. But I will tell you that a lot of them are kind of like otaku culture tropes. So let's just say there's like the kind of ditzy kind of little sister replacement character. There's the smart and capable older sister kind of stand in. There's like a literal maid cafe worker who the friend of the protagonist is in love with. And the aforementioned friend of the protagonist is, his name is Daru, is kind of like a fat computer nerd and super into the going to the maid cafes and things like that. So there is a lot of like fan service, I guess, if you want to call it that way. Not so much in the cheesecake variety, but definitely like some illusions and some like gender stereotypes and things like that. So
it's par for the course, unfortunately. If people,
yeah, especially with this kind of subgenre of visual novel. If anyone is sensitive to those considerations, then, you know, please be forewarned about this particular series. So the characters, the main character and his buddy are computer nerds, self-professed geniuses, and they're working on their brilliant inventions, but none of them are very clearly defined. They're just creating like invention after invention, and a lot of them are just kind of like half thought out flops. But early on in the story, the protagonist attends this kind of conference or presentation by a real scientist who says that he's invented time travel. And that's yet to be explained or not. And then eventually, a series of events starts happening. And I'm not going to spoil too much. This is all quite early in the story. What happens is that Okarin has a series of encounters where things can't possibly be the case, so that he'll experience things happening, and then the following day he'll have a talk with that same person, and they don't remember it happening. So basically, this is a delusional character, and he has even more and more reason to doubt the basis of reality going around him.
Or is he being gaslit?
He could be being gaslit, but he's building up enough proof that the world is changing unbeknownst to him, and no one else seems to be aware of why and how. So this is inherently interesting because it's a mystery. This mystery is unraveling slowly. And I've played this game for over, you know, a dozen hours. I think I've probably played it for 15 hours or so. It's quite long. I haven't beat it, but there's lots and lots going on in this series, this entry. And not a lot of it makes direct sense. I think there's an anime corollary that I can think of, which I've watched before. It's called, what is it called? It's something Suzumiya Haruhi. It's a kind of another otaku plot, otaku, popular otaku anime, and I think it's based off of a light novel, but it has to do with time loops. And for about like four episodes straight, the episodes of that show show exactly the same events. And the only interest you see is pulling out very, very minute differences in the sequence of happenings. And this game very much has that going on. There's the secondary characters as well. There's a kind of a, I guess, like a trans woman, girl, actually, because it's a younger person. And she is a temple family, like that runs a temple nearby, and the main character has an exchange with them. And there's also this younger woman who needs information out of the main character for various reasons, but she will only talk through texting, even if she's standing right in front of you. So there's just the whole range of wacky characters going on. What this game builds up to, which is quite interesting, is that eventually the main character will have accidentally invented a device that seems to be able to transmit not people, but information back and forward in time. So that sort of unravels a little bit of the why that things might be happening, is because they've discovered, basically through kind of duct taping a cell phone and a microwave together, that they can send information back to themselves in the past, for instance. And they're just unraveling, running experiments to see.
So they were gaslighting themselves all along.
Yeah, exactly. So that explains some of the unexpected events. And there is one redeeming character who I think is quite solid. There's this kind of, what is her name? Her name is Kurisu, Makise Kurisu. And she is that kind of young, capable woman. She is like a MIT grad, even despite being just like a 19 or something. And she's like just super physics genius.
Wunderkind.
Wunderkind, yeah, exactly. And she's kind of like this grounding factor. So she doesn't take any guff. And she kind of acts as a foil to Okarin, who, as a primary character, is a little much. I won't lie there. So if some of this sounds a little bit not your style, know that there is some good female representation in the characters. It's not just about male fantasies and things like that. There is actually some interesting writing in there, but a lot of it is colored with that otaku lens. So you probably know if you're into that sort of stuff in that or not. So really, yeah, what holds it together for me is really the mystery and what exactly is going on, seeing the minute differences. And the art's quite good. Even on PS Vita, this game, which is mostly told through just like nice color illustrations of characters and painterly backdrops of
like the paper cutout puppets moving around.
Yeah, that's right. And the music's decent as well. So if you like watching anime that talks about otaku culture, this will be right up your alley. It is quite long-winded, though. I actually stopped playing it after a while, after I think 14 or 15 hours, just because it takes a long time to get to the point. And really, I don't know if it ever will get to the point. They just kind of tease out information a little bit, and a little bit at a time. So I eventually lost patience with that and had to step away. But they leave enough interesting threads that I am interested in going back. So I think this is kind of an uneven product, but I think there's a lot of good things there as well. So a couple of other points before I move on is there's an interesting kind of UI to this game, which it puts it right in the moment in 2009. This has a very distinctive cell phone based UI. So there's like a kind of Japanese style flip phone interface that pulls up pretty much right from the beginning. And it has Okarin answering text messages, and mostly just answering text messages, to be honest, browsing forum threads and things like that to find hunt down information about trying to some of these mysterious threads that he's trying to chase. And it's a lot like that game I mentioned, Murder on the Marine Express. And in fact, it was one of the short games I mentioned a few weeks back. And I can't help but think that Murder on the Marine Express must have been inspired by this game quite a bit, because it definitely uses the cell phone interface in quite the same way.
So you're actually processing text in multiple formats, like reading through wikis and things?
Yeah, that's right. So you're primarily having dialogue with other characters where they're standing in front of you and you're looking them in the eye and talking to them. Or
talking heads, yeah.
Or narrating. But you will also pop into your cell phone interface and you'll get the little cell phone alert like mid-conversation with other characters. So you have that kind of attention of, should I rudely step away and duck my head in the phone and read some of these text messages? And interestingly enough, there is some interaction in that the text messages, when you respond to them, it's not just like I respond like you do in, say, Persona 5, if you remember that UI at all. There, within one text message response or text message that they send you, there might be like two or three highlighted words. So you choose which kind of flag to pull on, which kind of thread to pull on, and then that defines what response you send. So if they're talking about the old retro computer, or they're talking about the maid cafe, you can ask about a specific one, and you don't get to ask about the other one. So that much of it is a little nod to interactivity and distinctiveness. So you could have your own playthrough of this game as opposed to that Murder on the Marine Express where you just have the one plot that gets spelled out to you and you can't affect
it. Is the broad structure otherwise pretty linear, or like
it's
play with multiple endings or anything? Okay.
I don't know if it does play with multiple endings. I haven't seen any indication that it does. But with the main plot twisting and turning so much as it is, it sort of feels like you're following along. And it feels like there's the potential that you could be affecting it. But no, I don't see that it is strictly playing out in a non-linear fashion according to your direction, like a game like 13 Sentinels or Virtue's Last Reward does. No, this does feel like you're playing quite linearly through it. But I thought that UI, that interface, was a nice touch, and I think it's implemented directly. So yeah, not much interactivity there. And I'll go on to say that this game is received quite well. Like I said, there's a Steins Gate 2, if I'm not mistaken, and there's a Steins Gate 0 as well. And both of these are available on Steam, at very least, and potentially other platforms as well. And they get pretty good ratings overall. On Metacritic, it's like 85%, and 100% on OpenCritic, if you can.
It's hard to know how to read those ratings for like these very niche genres, where it's generally only people who already know what they're looking for will play these sort of games.
And this game, Steins Gate, is sort of like one of those pillars of the Japanese visual novel scene, at least this kind, the non-romantic kind, anyway. So it's very, very popular like that. Other examples I can think of are Robotics Notes is another series that's fairly popular. Maybe even by the same publisher. Anyways, I'll need to go back to this one to give a final review, but I'm enjoying it so far. But like I said, it's a little bit tiresome after a while, and I'll have to jump back into it to see if it ultimately pays off. But I like a mystery, so I'm always drawn in by one, let's just say.
Got your claws in you.
Yeah.
Very cool. Okay, well, I thought in the interest of getting some tabletop content on the podcast today, we should talk about a little game that we both played. Because we've only just played this the once. This is not a robust review, just some initial impressions. But that game is Brian Boru, High King of Ireland. This was released in 2021, designed by Pierre Sylvester, and publisher was Osprey Games. Oh, artist was Deirdre DiBara, by the way. And so this is a trick-taking game mixed with area control, something akin to something like Arx, I guess, where it's not primarily a trick-taking game. It's using trick-taking as that language to control and constrain this other set of mechanisms, basically. So if you recall, I think it was a year or two ago, I was talking about Pierre's previous game, The King is Dead, which left a really strong impression, that real sort of knife fight in a phone booth, sort of very tight constraints as an area control game. And this is obviously playing with some similar ideas. So, Mark, you joined me. We had a four-player game of this. What did you think of Brian Boru?
I made an offhand joke that probably unappetizing that this game is called Brian Bore You. But it didn't bore me too much. It was actually a pretty pleasant game. The trick-taking element is fairly central, but it's not so bad because you don't have to win the tricks necessarily. It's good if you do, but there are other benefits if you play lower and you might want to intentionally lose the trick depending on what certain results you need to take. And I thought that it was actually a fairly dry kind of point salad-y game, really, when you boil down to it. There were the area control on the map, but there's also area majority on, three different tracks on the main board as well. I think
it's basically three tracks or mini games that you're that you're interacting with, and it has some sense of majority or being first at the top of the track, right. Essentially.
It's the marriage, the Vikings, and the church, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
And they were all fairly similar with each other. I think it really just kind of boils down to situationally where you want to be, depending on which cards that you draw. And I thought that there wasn't enough distinction between them to really be satisfying or innovative. But the moment-to-moment gameplay was fun enough. And I don't know, you know, I don't know if it was scintillating for me or would be on the second or third or fifth play. But, you know, I think that this is a good foundation. And depending on whether they put out a meaty expansion or not, maybe, you know, that might interest me to pull back in.
Yeah, I don't know that an expansion is likely at this point, but the one thing we did have concerns with was the trick-taking aspect. It's just 25 cards, and there's three colors split across those 25 cards, but sort of scattered across those. The numbers are independent of the colors, essentially. There's also some white wild cards in there as well, and we struggled a little bit with, like, knowing what card was which. Like, well, it's a yellow. We're playing yellow, but was the highest yellow 18, or was it 21? Or, like, what exact numbers are coming up to, like, know how what your chances are of taking a particular trick.
That's
I think
right.
We felt that we either wanted less cards to be able to know that, like, to be able to read that information more easily, or more cards, and so there's a little more uncertainty, and, like, some cards aren't in every round, for example, because as it is, like, all but one card was in every round.
Yeah, that's right. And inherently, people are going to be able to memorize what card is what color. I think, like, the 25 or the highest value card was blue, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
And quite a number of the higher value cards, you know, 20 plus, are white. And then I should explain also that the given colors, I think they're orange, white, what was it, green and blue?
Yellow, green, and blue.
Yeah. So each of those corresponds with one of those area majorities.
Sorry, I was yellow, red, and blue. I said green.
Right. It was either the marriage track, which, pleasantly enough, wasn't always to women. There was, I think there was a fetching gentleman in there as well.
That you I had a husband and a wife.
Exactly. Ooh, enticing. That you could engage with. So some of them were just for the marriage track, and some of the specific colors were just for the Viking track, and some of them were for the church. And then I forget what the white one corresponded to.
It was a wild, basically, but it usually gives you some money or, like, gives you some other miscellaneous bonus. But, I did like that each color is basically associated with each of the mini games or each of the tracks, essentially. I did control somewhat, like, what you're, like, you might think that you want to go hard on the churches this round and you just don't really get any blue cards or don't have enough to influence that, at least. But there is a little bit of a draft at the start of each round.
Yeah, and a lot of it is reading what the situation is at the board and then kind of trying to read what your opponents are trying to achieve. For instance, there's the inherent advantage of being the last player to play a card in a given trick, of course, as you might imagine. And
the reaction opportunity.
Yeah. Right. And being able to control who would go next, there are a couple of cases where you can define who leads the trick. Typically, it's whoever won the previous trick leads the next trick. So that part of it is interesting itself. You can override that through, I think, activating Winning at the Church, if I'm not mistaken, for a given round. So that part is cool. And then there's some kind of penalties you earn if you don't contribute, or if you're the one that least contributes to the defense of the Vikings. And then certainly you gain some nice advantages when you win the heart of the betrothed. But another thing we didn't explain is that in each of these cards you play down, not only do they have a value which counts towards the trick-taking exercise, but they have kind of like two lesser actions on the bottom part of the card. So whenever you resolve the trick-taking round, you yourself can choose one of the two bottom actions on the card that you played. Basically, higher value cards have, I guess, what, like weaker abilities, and lower value
slightly
cards
are stronger.
Slightly stronger. So, you know, that's one of the reasons why you might want to lose a trick per se. And then only if you win the trick do you get to utilize the topmost ability, the third action on a given card, which is kind of in the top half of the card above the card art. So it's very, very clear that only the winner will get to activate that. And that's a super duper ability, but they're all about the same. You either take money, or you contribute towards the church, or you contribute towards the Vikings, or you contribute towards the wedding by sending love letters, I think it is.
Mm-hmm. But so you're always getting something. Even if you don't have a hand that's going to win tricks, you can still influence the board state and pull something out of that. And it's, again, it's largely about the hand you're dealt with and making the most of that.
Yeah, I thought the most interesting aspect of the game was the jockeying for a position on the map itself, which is interesting because that usually doesn't interest me in a lot of area control games, is controlling the board state of the people on a map per se. But because the kind of the territories were delineated with borders, and then you basically expanded out along these nodes, these lines from territories you currently control, you would have to be really clever about deciding, as the person who starts the trick, where the action is going down. So you, as the person leading the trick, choose the leading color, of course, although that could be wild. But generally, you're choosing a leading color. Maybe it'll be a high card, maybe it'll be a low card. But if you are pretty sure you're going to lose that trick, then you might want to put it in a disadvantageous area. And you might want to put it in an area that has no, basically, roads leading off of it. That way, whoever wins it is isolated, they cannot expand. Whereas if you're confident you could win it, you would want to place it where there are roads that can escape and expand, and maybe even roads that branch off into a neighboring territory. And then I think you were fighting over an interesting area where it was basically just a ring, right? So you could lock
the donut
down
in the middle. Yeah.
Yeah, that was quite cool as well. So I thought that was one of the more interesting aspects of the game, and reminded me a little bit of that area control game, not Aura and Labora, the other one, Turn and Taxis, the one about the Central European mail system, the Bavarian mail system. I like that one quite a bit.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's not one of those area control games where you have perfect control over the strategies and making clever plays necessarily. There's always that uncertainty in whether you can win a trick or pull off a certain move. It's almost like this sort of fog of war. It's never guaranteed what you can do. It's a bit of chance and luck there, obviously. But yeah, there's a lot of nuance baked into trick-taking inherently that this utilizes to take in some fun directions. The thing I liked about it was that those mini games where you usually get a bonus for having the most in one of these tracks or majorities at the end of a round, but everyone keeps their progress for the future rounds, except for the person who wins. They sort of reset their progress. So you want to win, but only just enough, because if you overinvest, that's all wasted. So that has this real satisfaction of like threading the needle. If you can win like by just 1 point, it's enough to like you don't waste all that additional progress.
Yeah, of course. And if you're in the last hand of the round or something like that, then there are also different considerations because, you know, you just want to edge someone out. It turns out that someone's catching up to you on the church track or something like that, and you might have to necessarily invest in the church track if you want to retain your lead, even though that wasn't your primary goal at the beginning of the round or the round before. So there are, like I said, the interest comes in playing against the players, whereas I think moment to moment, the thematicness of the actions and the variety of the choices that you make isn't that exciting. There's something about that gels together generally favorably.
It's quite snappy, for one thing. I think it has a good flow. I'm like, for example, I was trying to get the a husband one round, and like the only way of going up on the husband track is to have the yellow cards and play those yellow cards as part of a trick. I hoarded like 4 of the 6 yellow cards, and so I was able to sort of monopolize that track and get a cheap husband, basically, not have to invest much effort into that.
Yeah, that's right. So there you have the opportunity to strategize and executing on that strategy, and you also have the necessity to adapt when things don't exactly go your way either. So yeah, you're very interesting choices. I think this is a good game.
Yep, I'm looking forward to trying it again.
There you go. We'll see if it passes muster on the second and third time out.
I feel like it's a good one to take to TCTC. I know, I think it was 2 years ago I took King is Dead and played that a lot. I think this is a sort of good midweight Euro that I might try and bring out there.
Nice. We'll How many players does that go up to? Is it just 4 like we played?
Up to 5.
Okay. That would be very interesting at 5.
Mm. Yeah, I'm curious. I want to try that out.
Cool, cool. Did you want to cover another game?
I could do, or we could try and keep this episode short again.
I think it's not a problem to keep it short. We're already nearly at the hour. Shall we move into dessert?
All right, let's bank that for a future episode then. Okay.
Sounds good. All right, we're moving on to our dessert section. So this is where we talk about something not gaming related that we've been interested in recently. And I often cover books and manga and things like that, and I've covered music sometimes. This time around, I'm going to do a topic I don't often do, which is movies. It's usually your department. So I'm going to cover a movie I watched a few weeks ago with my youngest kid. They and I have a tradition of watching and listening to musicals. And so this time I wanted to put up a classic. And this was West Side Story. And this is the 2021 version, by the way, not the 1961.
Oh, the remake.
1961, yeah. So there was, what is that, 50 years? No, 60 years. So I hadn't seen it before, and I did watch it this time. So this was the Steven Spielberg directed version. This is the, like I said, the second filmed version of the legendary stage musical. Of course, most people know that the music is by Leonard Bernstein and the lyrics are by Stephen Sondheim himself, a noted Broadway musical composer and lyricist. So I won't cover all the basics. People know that this is a modernization of Romeo and Juliet. I will just say what they did well with this update. First of all, the cast is fantastic. I think they basically did a perfect job of all of the leads and the main supporting cast. This is led by Ansel Elgort and Rachel Zegler, who this was Rachel who plays Maria. Her first film credit, I believe, and she just knocked it out of the park. What a fantastic Maria. Very youthful energy, beautiful singing voice. And it's supported by veterans of film and stage, like Ariana DeBose, who was in the filmed Netflix version of The Prom, if I'm not mistaken, and other things as well. There's a couple other credits I'm sure she's been in, basically all the movie musicals she's in, and she's played a fantastic Anita. And another highlight was Riff, who's played by someone I didn't instantly recognize. His name is Mike Faist. He's a stage actor, and he apparently originated the role of Connor Murphy in the stage version of Dear Evan Hansen. So all these people obviously know their stuff. They are experts in their field, and they cast the right people. Well, but what about the film itself? This is an old subject matter. It was fresh at the time. I think it was a 1957 play, and they filmed the first version in 1961. So that's only 4 years after going on Broadway. So that's like fresh, right? I'd seen the 1960s one before, but it'd been a long time. And it looks like weird, man. Because that's like Star Trek, the original series period, right? Like the 1960s.
Early.
So actually earlier than that even. Because I think Star Trek was like 68 or 9. Anyways, it was just a different universe in the 1960s for film. This one looks really fresh. The production values are very traditional. The costuming and the set direction looks very true to period. So there's no funky space sci-fi adaptation or anything like that. This is just basically 1950s America that is being presented here. And strictly speaking, in New York, of course, where basically lower class white Americans, Irish and immigrants, Eastern European families and youths are at conflict with some of the Puerto Rican gangs, the neighboring Puerto Rican immigrant gangs. So that's where the inherent tension lies. And I thought I'd mention this one this week as well, because pretty much as I'm recording this, the Super Bowl was going on today, where Bad Bunny, noted Puerto Rican American music superstar, is headlining, and somehow there are a lot of Americans up in arms about Spanish speaking, predominantly, entirely Spanish speaking and singing music performers headlining the halftime show act. So a lot of the politics in this movie are alive and well, even today.
Mm-hmm.
Another highlight of this is they were pretty faithful to the original material, although they invented some new dialogue and some new kind of like non-singing scenes, really mostly to make it a little bit more realistic and credible in this day and age. Of course, stamping and dancing and snapping and singing gangsters is the kind of the joke about the original West Side Story, right? Ooh, how scary, how threatening. This movie feels dangerous. Like my youngest kid, who's 11, was covering their eyes at some of the scenes, like kind of the knife fights and things like that. It's kind of violent and quite brutal and does feel very dangerous. So that's definitely the modern aspect of it. That's really, really present in that as well, that sense of danger. It's filmed beautifully. It's obviously mostly on sound stages in like two square blocks of New York City and kind of this broken down slum area. But what they have produced looks fantastic. Definitely a worthy Spielberg production. And the absolutely coolest thing that they did was they rewrote one of the characters. So I don't know if you're familiar with West Side Story. I was actually in a stage production of it myself in my youth, so I'm fairly familiar with it. There's a character called Doc, who's basically the only adult in this world who's on the side of the kids, who's on the side of the lovers, Maria and Tony, who are star-crossed lovers, of course. There's this character called Doc, and he's just this old dude that runs a pharmacy in the original play and film. But they've rewritten it so that instead of a man, the character of Doc is fulfilled by a woman called Valentina. And how they wrote it is that Doc still exists in the universe, but he died. And Valentina is his widow, and she is of Puerto Rican descent. So this is all the more prescient and impactful because she's kind of like the stand-in for Maria, right? Doc, who is deceased, is the stand-in for Tony. They're a couple that made it happen, crossed the cultural divide, and came together and have a loving relationship and made a life for themselves in this world. And we all know how Romeo and Juliet ends up. So it doesn't work quite that way. Turns out that Valentina is played by a notable actress, Rita Moreno, who is of Puerto Rican descent. And she is one of the very few American performers who is an EGOT. So Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, and Tony winner. So absolute legend. And she played Anita in the original West Side Story. So they just kind of brought it all back, made it full circle, and is all the more full impactful for her being there. So really powerful. Unfortunately, I don't think it performed well in the box office. It didn't make the initial make back the investment in it. But I think it'll stand the test of time as a very well-made adaptation. Beautiful to look at, and it's just kind of keeping the spirit of that fantastic source material alive. So that's West Side Story. From 2021, well worth watching, and hey, the music is beautiful, so go check it out.
Cool. Yeah, I do have to say that is a blind spot of mine. I've not seen the original either, but I do need to check that out sometime. Very cool.
The original is like laughable to look at. Just all the actors just like old people, like adults of the time. Just
I do know I think it's the male lead is Ben from Twin Peaks, which is hard to take seriously, to be honest. But
maybe it's sure. So long ago.
Okay, so I was going to talk about a movie I watched called 28 Years Later, which just came out last year. I did really enjoy that, just very quickly. It was a sort of... It tweaked the zombie genre to be more than just horror and took it in some fresh new directions that I really appreciated. So I think that's worth checking out. But what I wanted to talk about instead, something I just watched last night. You mentioned Star Trek earlier, and my wife and I have been continuing to watch through that. It's been a bit of a delay because Netflix is no longer streaming it now. I guess it's locked into Paramount Plus. So we have to wait on the DVDs from the library now. So we finally, we're wrapping up season 5, and we just watched an episode called Inner Lights, which seems to be widely regarded as one of the best Trek episodes, and I do have to agree. For those who don't recall, this is the one where Picard is basically transported to another life. Like he wakes up in another person's body, married to a woman, and like lives a whole life, or at least half of a life, as this other person, basically. And I mean, I've certainly seen parodies of that in like, you know, Rick and Morty, and both serious and satirical takes on that. That it is a fascinating sort of theme to explore, and like how that changes you, basically. Just this, even if it's not real, it's still a lived experience that you're going through. But the biggest takeaway for me, I guess, was actually something that resonated with I was talking last week about Outer Wilds, and how it's sort of this balm against nihilism and, you know, meaning in the face of existential obliteration. And that's what the people in this are facing. It's like this whole experience that Picard is living is basically a memorial to a people who like their whole planet died out due to a supernova, and this is their way of sort of being remembered. And I thought that was a really touching message. And yeah, just it's how you react and deal with that existential threat.
Yeah, this episode is very memorable to me. I watched it again not too long ago, maybe like 5 years back, and it's just as impactful as it was when I originally watched it. And I don't want to spoil too much, but let's just say that his experience comes back to the screen in small degrees, often, actually, even in just the couple of remaining seasons that are on the show. Like, the writers realize how impactful this episode was to not only the audience, but to Picard. So they have callbacks to, definitely to the flute, anyway, over and over and over.
I've definitely seen memes of Picard playing the flute, yeah. I mean, it's reading through some of the commentary in that episode, it is a challenge with this sort of episodic, you know, case of the week style storytelling to continue these stakes forward. Like, an experience like this does like fundamentally change you as a person. How do you express that and still keep the fun hijinks week to week, I guess?
Yeah, I think by this point, what did you say? It was fifth season that Inner Light was?
Yeah, end of fifth.
Yeah, at this point, the writers really kind of got to know who these characters are, because obviously the actors had been performing them for so long. So many episodes had been written that this is an opportunity for Picard to live a life that he never thought he would be able to, you know, settle down, have a family, have children, have a loving wife and relationship. And it that's why it changes him, because he never let himself have that in his, you know, day-to-day life being the captain of a starship.
It's the road not taken, right?
Absolutely. And some of my favorite episodes of Next Generation, at least, do just that with the variety of other characters. They just kind of take a character and then they just put them in a life that they weren't expecting to get. I believe there's an episode of where Data, for instance, is lost on this kind of like 16th century world where the understanding of science is so limited. And people don't understand that he's an android and he doesn't remember that he's an android either. So he's having to deal with a entirely different life. And there's another one where Riker has a disease or something like that. And he loses like 20 years of his memory and he gets transported essentially to the future where he has a wife and a son, and there's an interesting outcome to that as well. So there's a few episodes where that happens, where characters are whisked away to a different life, and those are always very revealing about what the character's inner desires and, I guess, regrets are, which is, you know, great sci-fi in my opinion.
Yep, looking forward to wrapping that up. And then speaking of Star Trek, I did just watch another episode of Columbo, where the villain was played by Leonard Nimoy. And that was one of the best episodes of that we've seen so far. It was really, really compelling. Like, it wasn't just the solve the murder. It was actually like a ticking clock that they had to solve it by a certain time. That was added some extra tension to that. So that was a good episode as well.
Nice. Love the crossovers. Very cool. All right, Daniel. I think that's a good place to wrap it up. And lots more stuff to cover, obviously. Just hints to those out in listening world. We've been dropping hints that we've been playing some Zelda games, so we'll just tease that there'll be some Zelda coverage to be coming. I'm not sure if it'll be next episode, but probably Daniel and I are going to be covering one or two entries of that long-running series. It's been a while since we covered, I think it was like Breath of the Wild, perhaps a year or two ago.
Well, Tears of the Kingdom, I'm pretty sure we covered at some point. Yeah.
Yes, that's what it was. So if anyone has thoughts about their favorite Zelda entry, or one that we should look at in more detail, then please shout out and let us know.
Yes, right. If you have any questions or comments, you can contact us at omnigamersclub@gmail.com or at our website, omnigamers.club.
That's right. If anyone's interested, you can follow me on Blue Sky at markyuasa.bsky.social. And how about you, Daniel? Where can people follow you?
You can find me at Blue Sky at Board Game Feast and the Omni Gamers Club account there as well.
Very good. All right. People should also check out our episodes on YouTube if they haven't yet. We record and put up videos of each episode that we put out. And if you're interested in listening to our older material, our very earliest episodes are only in audio form. So check those out on a podcatcher of your choosing. We'd love to hear your feedback about any of the games that we covered. Or if you'd like us to check out a game that interests you, just reach out and let us know.
Yes, always happy to have listeners join the club. Thank you all for listening, and thank you, Mark. And remember to have a balanced diet of games.
Bye.